WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Two snarling attack dogs confronting a cowering detainee. That was the subject of the latest photograph released today of abuse and torture at Abu Ghraib. The images are searing. A smiling guard with cigarette dangling. Naked prisoners stacked like logs on a woodpile. The firestorm over those photographs has become the most heated front of the war in Iraq. The fallout reaches the highest levels of the Bush administration. Tonight on Point, the larger implications of show and tell. But first, a closer look at the chain of responsibility for the torture at Abu Ghraib. Critics have claimed that the Bush administration turned a blind eye, even as groups like the Red Cross and Amnesty International reported abuses months ago. John Diamond is a reporter covering U.S. intelligence for USA Today. I asked him when top officials of the Bush administration first learned of the abuses.
The call came from Baghdad about 2 days after the night of January 13th, when Specialist Joseph Darby left a computer disk containing these photos we've now all seen on the army cot of an investigator who immediately recognized their importance and alerted his superiors. Within a couple of days, the word went back to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, and General John Abizade, who's the commander in Iraq, said this is going to be a big deal. And that was the first word. Of course, we now know that it was many months before Myers and Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld actually saw the images themselves, which makes a big difference.
That was certainly Rumsfeld's argument last week in his testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Right. But from the very first, they were being told by a senior commander, four-star General Abizade, that this was a huge development. They weren't just alerting them, hey, FYI, we're doing an investigation of some prison abuse. General Abizade made it clear that this was going to be a major deal. He must have realized that at some point there was going to be a court-martial, which would essentially be like a public trial at which some of this stuff might very well be shown. So there was, an understanding from the beginning that sooner or later this was likely to get out, and when it did get out, it was going to be a major, major story.
Well, in terms of these high-level detainees in particular, at this point Saddam had been taken. Were there clear instructions from the Pentagon about the rules of interrogation? Did they monitor these cases closely, as far as we know?
As far as I am aware, there were not clear instructions down the chain of command about do's and don'ts. There were long-established laws and treaties controlling the handling of prisoners, and basically they are quite clear. No torture, no physical abuse, no intimidation, no threats of death, no restraining in uncomfortable positions, no psychological torture, no humiliation, right down the line. But what we're seeing in testimony from some of these prison guards is that they were not trained in what to do and what not to do. They didn't have copies of the relevant Geneva Convention passages in front of them or of the Army regulations. And so you had people in charge of large numbers of prisoners in a very tense situation. That Abu Ghraib prison is right in the middle of a hot battle zone in Iraq, where they did not have guidance in front of them. Meanwhile, the guidance that was coming down the chain of command was, we need information. We need information about pending attacks that might be coming on U.S. soldiers. The whole period, late 2003, early 2004, of course, a very violent period in Iraq, where with daily attacks, daily fatalities, and a very well-organized and violent insurgency going on. And there was an imperative to try to get information and sort of crack who, you know, to find out who the bad guys are, where are they, what are their plans, where are their weapons, that sort of thing. And, of course, these guards were the comrades of the people getting killed every day, and they themselves were getting shot at every day. So as the report by General Tacuba, which is being quoted all over the place, this is the investigative report of prison abuse, that report points out that while the abuses themselves are totally inexcusable, they were happening in a context where higher-ups were demanding information, and when the people down at the level of the prisoners were being shot at regularly.
Well, once those concerns were raised, though, John, wouldn't it be normal procedure for someone to write a memo reminding all the links of that chain of command what's okay and what isn't?
Yeah, we don't see that happening, and it's the absence of such guidance from the top that may become a major problem for Secretary Rumsfeld as Congress takes a closer look at this. And we also, of course, see that there seemed to have been no guidance from the top to say that if commanders further down the chain of command hear about abuses, that the top people at the Pentagon should be alerted immediately. And so, for example, we have the Red Cross in October of 2003 going to the Abu Ghraib prison, finding some of the very abuses that now show up in these photos, briefing the local prisoner officials on these problems. But those officials never really alert anyone back in Washington, or at least so Secretary Rumsfeld says. He says he was unaware of the Red Cross critique in that case, although he had heard Red Cross reports in other situations.
Well, and we're not just talking about sleep deprivation, for example. There was a new picture that was released today that showed a cowering, naked inmate with guard dogs on either side. And there are reportedly, as you know, other pictures of rape and murder. So is there any way of knowing at this point whether these were the acts of a few people or if the mission simply was, as you suggested earlier, get information and, you know, we're not going to question you too closely as to how you got it?
There's now strong evidence pointing in the direction of this being part of a broader plan to soften up prisoners, although that issue is very much at the center of the whole dispute here. General Myers, Secretary Rumsfeld were insisting that this was the act of a few bad actors. That was their line at the hearing last week. But we have other information, for example, the recommendations last September by General Miller, who is sent by the Office of the Secretary of Defense from Cuba to Iraq to look at the prison situation there and to try to get better results out of interrogations. It's General Miller that recommends that the guards in the prisons be put under the control of the intelligence officers, which is a change that did indeed happen right around the time these abuses were going on and which may well have contributed to the guards' excesses that we see in the pictures. Because the guards, multiple guards, although admittedly they are trying to defend themselves now against criminal charges, they have testified consistently that they were told to do the things they did, that they were told to make sure these prisoners had a bad night, give them rough treatment, make sure they were softened up for the morning interrogation. The fact that this stuff happened on the overnight shift is presented by the Pentagon as a sign that this was just sort of sadistic guards at play when nobody was watching. But the overnight shift is the period when, if you were going to work on a suspect, that's when you do it, right before their early morning interrogation. And the abuses are only occurring in this one cell block wing where a fairly small and particular group of detainees were being held who were thought to have valuable information.
And is there a feeling where you are of another shoe about to drop?
There's no question. We've been told in open hearings that there are more images to come out. It seems that virtually every day brings a new picture that's released to the public. There's now a debate at the Pentagon as to whether to just go ahead and release all the material at once to sort of stop this bleeding. And it's unclear what will happen, but there's no question that there's a great deal more imagery and that it could be equally disturbing. But I think that the new revelations that will be significant won't be so much the pictures, as powerful as they are, but will be evidence, if it develops, that higher-ups were more knowledgeable and more involved in the whole interrogation process than they have claimed up till now.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
John Diamond is a reporter covering U.S. intelligence for USA Today. He spoke with me from Washington. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is facing increasing pressure to step down for not responding more rapidly to the abuses at Abu Ghraib. At a Senate Armed Forces Committee hearing on Friday, Rumsfeld described the visceral impact of the photographs.
It is the photographs that gives one the vivid realization of what actually took place. Words don't do it. The words that there were abuses, that it was cruel, that it was inhumane, all of which is true, that it was blatant. You read that and it's one thing. You see the photographs and you get a sense of it. And you cannot help but be outraged.
A few moments later, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton criticized Rumsfeld for those comments, saying that the written reports of the alleged abuses should have been enough to prompt swift action from the Bush administration.
The atrocities that have been depicted in photographs were very graphically verbally described in the Taguba report. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to read those descriptions and have one's stomach just turn in disgust. The focus on the pictures being released is, with all due respect, missing the point.
Although abuse allegations had surfaced in January of this year, they only became front-page news when the photographs were aired in late April. So we ask, what was your reaction to the Abu Ghraib photographs? Were you shocked, or are they the harsh realities of war? Without the graphic pictures, would anyone be paying attention to what happened at Abu Ghraib? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Philadelphia is Carolyn Marvin, professor of communications at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication and also author of Blood Sacrifice and the Nation. Hi, Carolyn. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be there.
And also joining us from Washington is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, James.
Thank you. Good evening.
Carolyn, I want to start with you, and I wonder if you would just lay out the case for us, the argument for showing photographs, videos, whatever may emerge from this.
Well, I think that we're a democracy, and being a democracy means that you have to face the hard stuff. And we've been presented now with a very serious problem, and I think the only way to address it honestly and fully is to see what there is in terms of evidence.
And James, is there an argument against, or would your position be yes, but?
Well, I'm sure there is an argument against. It's not one I would make. The argument against is probably one you can imagine a strained and a less strained version. The strained version would be that this would, you know, undercut the situation of the troops, and in a sort of immediate tactical level, there's some case for delaying it. But I think, you know, the overwhelming case for doing it is not simply that democracy has to see the effects of what it's done, but particularly at this moment, when the military is so small a fraction of the entire public, less than 1% of the entire public is in uniform now, it is therefore the more important for the rest of us to have an idea of what's being done, you know, in our name.
Well, and what about the opinion of the world? Because should we care about that?
Sure, we should care about it, but the way to care about it is to, you know, not do these things in the first place and then to show some kind of appropriate response to them. But I think that I'm sure that Secretary Rumsfeld's life would be easier at the moment if these pictures had never been taken. But, you know, the reality of the treatment of the Iraqis certainly is known to members of the Iraqi public, and that will have an inevitable effect on our standing in the world.
And Carolyn, I take your point about this being a democracy, but isn't there also an issue of taste here? We understand that some of these pictures yet to come and some of the videos show rape and murder. I mean, do we really need to see that to get what happened?
Absolutely. I do think we need to see it. I'm not sure that Americans have been paying enough attention to exactly what's going on in Iraq, and perhaps this is the way that they need to think about it. It concerns me very much, I must say, that Secretary Rumsfeld wasn't able to key into the seriousness of what had happened until he saw the images. It's one thing for Americans to be slow. It's very different for the person who is in charge of our military operations over there to have required photographs to do it. I think that there certainly is some recognition of the limits of taste in the fuzzing of the genitalia of the prisoners, but I think that, you know, war is not a polite activity, and we can't expect the pictures of it to be polite. And this is such a serious issue that I think it really is important. Of course, individual news outlets will make their own individual judgments about which pictures they think it's wise for the public to see in something like this. I would be very surprised if lots and lots of pictures didn't get out for those people who are interested in finding them. I think we need to not be closing off that avenue.
All right, let me stop you there. Hold the point. We have a lot more to discuss about this issue this hour, and we're going to continue after we take a quick break. We're talking tonight about those photographs that came out of Abu Ghraib and the prison abuse scandal there. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the impact of those photographs of torture at Abu Ghraib. And we ask, do you identify with the guards or the detainees? And when you read stories about rape and torture, do you really need to see the pictures? When do those images become gratuitous? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Carolyn Marvin, professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, and also with James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. Carolyn, I had to cut you off as we were going into that break, and I want to give you a chance to complete your thought if you weren't able to, and also ask you to speak to some of the previous examples of pictures in wartime making a difference.
Well, of course, the most probably the best-known example are the photographs from the liberation of Buchenwald and other Nazi camps at the end of World War II. And that allowed people to see what really had happened. And it was very, very important that those photographs be released. This is a somewhat different situation, but I would say My Lai is another instance. I don't think there's ever been a circumstance in which the release of pictures like this has later been thought to be a terrible mistake. I think that these pictures have always been a way of focusing on, you know, what really is the case in war. And as to your point about do you identify with the guards or with the prisoners, I think the real lesson here is that human beings can be both oppressors and oppressed, and that we don't need to think of ourselves as not capable of this kind of activity, and we need to really get it out and talk about it and take measures against it, because there's no excuse for it.
Carolyn, you were mentioning the concentration camp pictures from World War II, and I wonder if it's your feeling that if those had become public earlier, would FDR have had to act?
That's a very interesting question, and I can't possibly say. Again, the pictures are so disturbing that I think there's no question that it would have had an enormous impact on public opinion, as these photographs, I think, are having an enormous impact on public opinion. And as James Fallows said, you know, the really important thing here is not the photos, which do have their own political consequences and are worth talking about in terms of the opinion of Europeans and the Arab world and the people in Iraq, but also, you know, it's the acts underneath that are the serious thing for us to talk about, not simply the fact that it's unfortunate that, you know, these images are loose.
And James, I know that you were around during Vietnam, and one of the images from that time that most people have engraved in their memories somewhere is the picture of the little girl running down the road after the napalm attack.
Sure. There were two pictures that had, you know, the same kind of iconic value. One is that, the other is of the South Vietnamese officer shooting suspected Viet Cong in the head on a street in Saigon. Again, a difference related to what I was mentioning earlier is that during the Vietnam War, there was quite a large swath of the public that was directly affected by that war, and it was on TV, you know, for years and years. And so there was a broader going-in awareness of what the realities were like, and those pictures accentuated it. But it was, you know, now very few Americans have been to Iraq, and so the shock value is intensified for that reason.
I was just going to ask about what is it about these images, do you think, that makes them so powerful?
Well, I think that there's... I'll answer that and add one other little political point if I could. I think, you know, these images are just intrinsically, they're almost pornographic, that they are pornographic. You know, the image of this this private Lindy England with a dog leash on the guy, naked guy on the ground, that's straight out of some, you know, sadist site. And so it is just, in any culture, this would be humiliating, and especially given the idea that this was, you know, the nation that the U.S. Was going in there to liberate. The political point I'd like to make is, as we were discussing earlier, Secretary Rumsfeld said until he heard about the pictures, he wasn't really attentive. There's a very, very large canvas of subjects about which the Secretary and the President have not really been curious in the conduct of the war, and it could be that a long-term effect of these shocking pictures to say, you know, hey, wait a minute, why wasn't anybody paying attention to the on-the-ground operating realities of how this war and occupation are being carried out?
And, you know, Carolyn, the last time we were having a conversation about pictures and controversy was a few weeks ago. At that time, the issue was coffins containing the remains of service people who were killed in Iraq. Do you see some irony there in how much worse it is to see these? You know, those seem very tame now by comparison.
Well, I think the Bush administration really has thought that if you could keep all the bad images out of the press, somehow the public wouldn't get excited about the war. I really want to underscore James Fallow's point about the inattention of the administration to things that would seem to matter. I mean, part of this was Wolfowitz's underestimation of the casualties of American casualties in Iraq by 200, as though somehow it really hadn't gotten through what the real price of sacrifice was. But, you know, I think what's really important about these images is that they are making visible not only that the administration seems in some way not to be paying attention to a number of aspects about the war that they ought to be making front and center, but that the American people are not. That's a very important point. And when you have a draft or some form of public service and everybody really does have a stake, you know, and you don't have a professional army that, as James Fallow says, represents less than 1% of the population, then there has to be an act of civic imagination that people have in order to be interested in what's going on in the war. And I think that's been largely lacking in this war. It's very disturbing. But these photographs make it very much harder to avoid that. Well, now, I have heard some arguments to the effect that, you know, somehow this is no worse than or than the situation where the four military contractors were burned and hung, you know, and these photographs were put forward. But it does seem to me that that's not really the point. The point really is not that everything goes because the other side behaves badly, but we have a military that is supposed to be disciplined, and this is a country and a military that has enough experience of war to know that it's not easy to have military discipline. War is not something where you only follow the rules when it's easy. There's a responsibility here, and I think the images throw all of that into a large public discussion that we should be talking about.
All right, and we're going to be hearing from some of our listeners in just a moment. But James, I wanted to ask you quickly before we take a phone call. You know, we don't know yet what these people might have had to say that could have conceivably saved American lives. And I wonder if, in your mind, does that make a difference in terms of the tactics that are used, and should it make a difference?
Well, you know, in discussion about whether or not torture is justified, the assumption is always that there's some information that would be valuable that might be gotten by torture. And there's two arguments that are made in the professional discussion of this. One is that torture doesn't work, that torture is ineffective because people will say anything. If there's something they're really trying to hide, this isn't going to get it out. The other argument is that even if it would work, it somehow is demeaning, you know, to a great nation built on principles to do this. And the combination of those two streams of logic has basically been enough for the U.S. military officially and I think unofficially to reject torture as a way of getting out information, even if you hypothesize that it could, you know, save hundreds or thousands of your own people's lives. The U.S. says that it won't do that. Moreover, most of these people, it looks like it was just, you know, humiliation. And from the sheerly practical point of view, word will get around in Iraq, and it's hard to think of anything the U.S. could have done that could have more destroyed its prospects for years to come, you know, in the Arab world than this.
To Erie, Pennsylvania now, we want to hear from Tim, who's on the line. Hi, Tim.
Oh, hello. I guess as far as the way I see this is, I was trying to look at pictures of the war over a year ago, and the websites that I would go to would be blocked that had pictures. And Al Jazeera was blocked in this country, and so were a lot of other sites that had photographs on them. So the rest of the world got to see photos of the war, let alone this so-called period of after the major hostilities have finished. But the, you know, the photographs are important because the public does not have those folders and those papers that Rumsfeld had and the chiefs of staff. You know, it's important because those images, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. And it really, I find it atrocious that the people like Rumsfeld, who have led us to war, he seems to be saying, well, geez, if I had just read in those folders how bad things were going, well, we might have been able to do something better. But now that we've got this photograph, we're just going to fix it up. These are people that lead a great nation into war. And by the way, this is a war of aggression. We've initiated aggression. It's an illegal war.
But Tim, let me ask you about the pictures point. Are there some pictures that you don't want to see, or do you think they should all be out there?
Well, listen, if I don't want to see them, I can turn off the TV or whatever. You know, but why shouldn't they be available to you know, this is being done in our name. Why shouldn't these pictures be available to us to see what's being done there? I have a photograph of about a 5-year-old girl whose legs are blown apart with it looks like her father holding her in his arms. You know, why should people think that this is a video game? You know what? We're going to have this very antiseptic delivery of this war. We're going to call things abuse when they're actually torture. We're going to call them abuse when they're war crimes.
Tim, thanks for the call. We take your point. And Caroline, I want to ask you to follow up on Tim's point and also the impact of these pictures getting out in real time. You know, during the Vietnam War, we certainly saw some brutal images, but they might be 3 weeks old. And I wonder if, in your mind, that makes a difference in terms of how we respond.
Well, these pictures actually were taken more than 3 weeks ago. It's my understanding is that most of them were taken in December 2003. The war is going on. There are policy decisions to be made. If we're making mistakes of this kind, we really need to be aware of it so that we can do something to change it, and I certainly hope we can. I'm wondering whether or not this makes such a huge difference among those citizens of the Middle East who already had a pretty terrible opinion of us to begin with, but I think the impact on people who might have been willing to give us the benefit of the doubt is probably very serious.
All right, to Spokane, Washington now, to Pearl. Hi, Pearl. Thanks for joining us.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I would like to say that I believe Rumsfeld should have been able to visualize accurately and completely what was going on there by the written word, because we hire intelligent leaders who can come to conclusions and decisions based on the written word. And so I don't think his argument that he didn't see the pictures until later is going to save him. Also, I think the public does need to see the pictures, because we respond to pictures, we get our information through media, television, etc., and it's important that we see the pictures, and I think it does give us some obligation to then respond to what we see and know there. I think that the American public needs to know what the Iraqi people are seeing and going through right now.
Okay, Pearl, thank you. Thanks. We appreciate the point. And that also raises another issue, James, which is what the American people are seeing versus what the Iraqi people are seeing, because some of the reports that are coming out apparently are a lot of the photographs and not so much of the administration saying we want to get to the bottom of this and these people are going to be court-martialed and so on.
Sure, and that is to be predicted. And a version of this has been going on for the last year or ever since the war began. There have been photoshopped images that have been around in the number of Arabic languages, newspapers, and websites, sort of, you know, asserting that a lot of things that we would consider atrocities or terrible, barbarous acts were being done by U.S. soldiers. The difference in this case is that there are the same photos that Al Jazeera can use that the New York Times and the Times of London, the Washington Post are also using. This isn't, you know, some kind of a selective Arab view of the truth, and that's why it is particularly difficult. I'll spend 10 seconds trying to make the case for some kind of moderate control of how these images are used. I think let's say there are 1,000 more of these photos, and we know that eventually they will have to get out. Maybe the administration could meet with a number of leading news organizations and say, let's agree on 100 of these that are representative, and we'll agree they show the whole range from the best to the worst, and put those out just because you could imagine that such an enormous group of them in real time could have some effect on the U.S. troops. But that's about the main case I could make for some kind of control.
Well, and also I wonder if you'd speak to the issue of people are very skeptical about what they see and read in the media. Do you think they would have believed this story if the pictures didn't exist?
No. You can imagine the editorial in the Wall Street Journal or the commentary on the Rush Limbaugh show if these pictures didn't exist about the stories that will be cooked up, by the enemies of America. So I think the photos have enormous probative value, not simply, probably even less in the rest of the world than they do in the United States. I think most of us would find it hard to imagine this was actually happening in its whole resonance if we didn't see, these photos of the grinning people, and Lord knows what is ahead. So it's another illustration of, a picture having tremendous emotional resonance beyond just a mere description.
Can I say that I have some concerns about the military meeting? The government meeting with the press in order to select the appropriate pictures, whatever that can mean, for release. I think that this is a case in which the press should not be seen to be negotiating with the government or agreeing with the government or, in fact, colluding with the government to present a set of pictures that the government thinks is acceptable. It's hard for me to imagine, though, of course, I have seen a very few number of these pictures like everyone else, what could be in those pictures that would compromise troop movements right. In any of the ways that we normally – this is the kind of thing that we normally think is a justified reason for limiting information.
I was not saying acceptable, but representative. If you say range from the best and the worst, and I could imagine a case where, just as General Myers apparently, 2 months ago, said, "Can you delay this for because we have there are going to be riots in Fallujah or wherever when this happens." I could imagine a strained case. My own instinct would be, these things exist; they have to become public because they're part of what our democracy has done.
Well, I guess what I would say to that, too, is that I find General Myers' argument unconvincing because the government can always say at any one point that, well, things are really bad right now and we can't release these photographs because this is the worst week of the war. I mean, this has been done and, that's too bad. If there is a real compromise to troop movement and so forth, that's one thing. But the concern that there will be more resistance to American troops, which I think is quite a justified concern, is not a concern that seems to me justified in this case for withholding the photographs. And I really deciding what Condi Rice and Donald Rumsfeld think is okay for Americans to see, or a representative, still, I think, is a very troubling idea. And I think the press would be in much better shape and the American case would be in much better shape without the government participating in that.
Carolyn, have to stop you there. We're going to continue in just a moment after a break. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the impact of the Abu Ghraib photographs. Do you need to see the pictures to understand the horrors of what happened? Do mere words fail to tell the story? And when do the graphic depictions become gratuitous? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking this hour with Carolyn Marvin, professor of communications at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, and with James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. And we want to go to one of our listeners now. Eileen is on the line from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Eileen. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Yes. I'd like to make a couple of points. The first point, I was a victim of sexual assault, held down with a gun against my head, and I don't think I needed to have a picture taken to have people believe me that I was sexually assaulted. And number two, well, that's not even the point I was trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is I think that by putting these pictures out there, you're just re-victimizing these poor people. And I also think that it is, isn't it against the Geneva Convention to be showing these pictures? I think it's really disgusting. So I'd like to hear your comment on that.
So you're saying you don't need to see them. You get it.
Well, I don't think anybody needs to see a picture of me being raped.
And if I could, I'd offer this distinction. I think I agree. No one needs to see a picture of you being raped, and everyone agrees that the rape of a person is a criminal act, just as the world agrees that what happened to those four contractors in Fallujah was barbarous and criminal, and I did see the raw footage of that and was literally nauseating. What was happening in this prison was not an individual criminal who victimized you. It was policy carried out by our government over a number of months by a large group of people in the chain of command. You know, and it may individuals may be judged to have broken various laws, but this was not, you know, one person who was in a criminal. This was our nation carrying out a policy, and we as its citizens need to see what the policy was.
Eileen, I want to give you a chance to jump back into the conversation if you'd like.
We don't need to see the pictures to know what it was. It was a gang rape. We don't need to see the pictures.
We have not. I mean, what we have seen was not. We haven't seen pictures of a gang rape to my knowledge. If you read, you know, the four words in the paper, some Iraqi prisoners were sexually humiliated. Would that conjure up to you exactly what you have seen in the last week of the photos?
Because I've been through it.
Again, do you understand the distinction I'm making between a criminal and sort of an act of state policy?
Yeah, it's just legal criminality. I mean, they thought they were being legal, but it's still illegal. It doesn't matter if it's by the government or by an individual. It's still illegal, and I don't think we need to see pictures of it on TV. I don't need to have my kids seeing it on the nightly news.
Thanks, Eileen, and appreciate your phone call, and that is an interesting point, James. I mean, I know you're a parent.
Sure, and I think that's why it's worth having all appropriate cautions for this and not dumping everything out, and it's why it's worth having the genital blurring. But I think, again, the analogy here would be to the two powerful photos from the Vietnam years, you know, the naked 10-year-old girl running down the street after a napalm bombing, that would, you know, violate most canons of child pornography to do that. And the other, the horrible violence of a man having his head blown off on the front page. It was different for people to see that reality than it was for them to read that villagers had been killed by napalm and that there was a kind of brutal war to find Viet Cong informants. It brought the reality home in a way that was different from what it had been before.
Carolyn, I want you to pick up on this point about humiliation versus abuse. You know, seeing someone with women's panties over his head versus someone who's cowering naked in front of a couple of snarling guard dogs.
Well, I think, you know, the definition of humiliation, the distinction between humiliation and abuse is very culturally specific, and I'm not sure it's so important for this discussion. Both things are entirely unacceptable. I agree with James Fowles that this is a state act. The point is we are not there. And the point is that it is hard for us not being there to appreciate what's going on. And I think anyone has the choice to turn off their television, and I think people will not want to look at every single photograph that's available. But it is terribly important that these photographs be aired so that it is clear that we are confronting what has happened and that we are willing to consider it and to debate it and to do something about it. I think the idea that we ought to protect ourselves from the realities of what's going on is not ultimately helpful to what we're trying to do, which is to get to a better place for everybody. I think that the photographs are not neutral. I think the caller is exactly right. But they don't necessarily do all harm or necessarily all good. They are powerful because they are able to do both harm and good. But in this case, this is what our government is doing, and we need really not to protect ourselves from the knowledge of what our government is doing by saying that these photographs are going to be prevented from being aired.
Let's go quickly now to Chris, who's on the line from Boston. Chris, quick comment, please.
Yeah, I got a second on that. I mean, we basically, the whole concept of us being a democracy, we aren't. We're a republic, and we've delegated our authority to the government. When we see something like this happen, we know that the government has basically failed us. I mean, I think it's the responsibility here to show those pictures just so that we understand what our government is doing.
Right.
It's almost because the government is saying we shouldn't see this is my reason that we should see this.
Okay, Chris, appreciate the phone call. James, I want to put it to you as someone who works for a monthly magazine. Are the standards different for a magazine than they are for a daily newspaper? I mean, by the time you could get a story in print or with pictures on something like this, they would pretty much be out there. I wonder if the arguments and discussions at the Atlantic Monthly would be different than what you might hear at the New York Times or the Washington Post.
Sure, although it's worth recognizing that it was a weekly magazine, the New Yorker, that was sort of putting the oomph behind this. I'm not sure exactly whether it was Hirsch or the CBS people who first got the Tacuba report, but it was a magazine that was behind it. In a way, magazines have more latitude, you know, if we had come across a bunch of these shocking images to run them, the newspapers, because it's a more selective audience. In a way, it's like cable TV, essentially, compared to broadcast that comes to magazines. Also, just because I can't resist saying it, in The Atlantic over the last year and a half, we've been sort of relentlessly demonstrating the way in which Secretary Rumsfeld, in particular, has brushed off all the caution signs about how the conduct of the war and the conduct of the occupation was going. And even though this particular nightmare was not exactly foreseeable ahead of time, it is exactly in keeping with other problems he's had.
Carolyn, you got about 20 seconds for the last word.
Well, to follow up on that point, I think the Wall Street Journal today said that military intelligence officers estimate that 70% to 90% of the people picked up in this prison were picked up by mistake, and that's very concerning. I mean, you don't know whether that means that there was reason to pick them up, and then they turned out to be no evidence against them, or whether they were just sweeps by relatively undertrained people, which is what it sounds like there were, and that this makes all of this just indicative of the fact that at the level of the ground, the Defense Department does not seem to have been doing what it ought to have been doing. We need to know.
Thank you, Carolyn Marvin.
You're welcome.
James Fallows, thank you to you.
Thank you for having me on.
You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In just a moment, the first trial related to the Abu Ghraib prison scandal is set. This is On Point. Army Specialist Jeremy Sivitz will be the first soldier to undergo a court-martial in the prison scandal. The 24-year-old from Hinman, Pennsylvania, will face a military court in Baghdad 9 days from now on May 19th. Sivitz is one of seven former soldiers at Abu Ghraib facing criminal charges. John Hendren is the Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him about the swift timing of that trial.
I am told that this is happening pretty much on pace with the usual military schedule. What's interesting to me is that they're choosing this Jeremy Sivitz to launch the first trial with. He is not apparently one of the worst offenders. He's not pictured in any of the photos that we've seen. And it sounds like what they're trying to do is get as much information out of him as they can to prosecute the others.
What are the charges against him?
He was charged with maltreatment of detainees, conspiracy to maltreat subordinates. That's just a reference to detainees. He's charged with dereliction of duty for failing to protect them and abuse, cruelty, and maltreatment.
Now, in your article, you say that he's facing an intermediate-level special court-martial. What does that mean exactly?
A special court-martial is limited to a level of penalties, 1 year in prison, and a discharge for bad conduct. Now, if he were given a general court-martial, he could have gotten up to 15 months plus a dishonorable discharge, which is a level worse. And those things suggest to me and to lawyers in the industry who know better that there's probably some kind of deal in the works where he wouldn't have gotten it so soft to start with.
And what are those indications?
Well, the indications are first of all, that there are not a lot of procedural motions that you might normally see, but more importantly, just that it's a special court-martial and not a general court-martial, so that the charges are already limited walking in.
Are there some elements here as well of something of a show trial. In other words, that the United States is clearly very interested in demonstrating that it's serious about these accusations, that it wants to show that it is pursuing them, that people are being brought to trial?
That would be suggested by the way they're setting this up, by making it a public trial in the convention center in the middle of the Green Zone in Baghdad and allowing Iraqi reporters in. I do think they're taking something of a risk in that, in the first case, the most that they can give this guy is a year, and it appears that they may have reached some kind of plea bargain with him in order to get information on the other suspects. So what you may have here is a fairly light penalty coming out of this in order to get further information on these other suspects. But that could also enrage Iraqis in the streets, and that's already become a problem in this case.
Well, you mentioned that Iraqi reporters are going to be allowed in. Will this be televised? Will cameras be allowed in as well?
Cameras will not be allowed, we're told, although reporters, just like in many U.S. trials, of course, could walk outside of the courtroom, presumably, and do live shots.
What do we know about this young man's past? Jeremy Sivitz grew up in a small town, I understand, in western Pennsylvania?
That's right. I talked to one of his neighbors the other day, one of his former substitute teachers. Apparently, he was, they said he was a fun-loving kid, but never malicious. He married a girl from the same small town, actually had to rush the marriage in order to get deployed. Had aspired to a career in law enforcement, but we don't know a whole lot more than that.
Was he trained as a prison guard?
No. In fact, he was trained as a mechanic, and when he was deployed, we're told, at least from friends and neighbors of his, that that's what he expected to do. It's a little unclear what happened. It may be that his entire unit was shifted to prison duty.
And so people in his hometown were, I take it, pretty surprised that he would be caught up in this.
Indeed. They're surprised and saddened, and it's become a real topic of discussion in that town. You hear people in this small Pennsylvania town where a lot of people, or a higher proportion of people than usual, are in the military, suddenly questioning larger issues in the war. I heard someone say, I hope justice is done for everybody and not just those that can pay for it. And that seems to be a reference to the higher-up commanders who, some say, set the conditions that these sort of lower-ranking soldiers just followed.
And what about his defense? The military assigns him a defense attorney, is that correct?
That's right. He gets a military lawyer for free. If he wants, he can pay for a private attorney as well. Of course, that's going to be a little difficult in Baghdad, but I'm guessing in a case that is this high profile, he's likely to get volunteers.
And who actually hears the charges against him?
You have a panel of military officers, could be as few as three, and if he wants, he can ask for one of them to be a non-commissioned officer like himself. However, he can also ask for a judge trial, just as you can in a civil case, and people often do that if the charges are so inflammatory that they're concerned that a jury is going to be less favorable to them.
And any idea how long a trial like this might go?
Usually military trials are fairly expeditious. They put a lot of stock in getting them done quickly. In this case, if he were actually to plead, if he were to have agreed on a plea bargain, they could go straight to sentence.
John, well, we thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
John Hendren is Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.